Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
It's time now for our panel discussion, and it's my pleasure and honor to introduce the moderator for today's panel discussion, Dr. Karen Philbrick, who is the Executive Director of the Mineta Transportation Institute at San Jose State University. Dr. Philbrick.
Thank you, Will. We're now pleased to begin part two of today's program. We have a variety of experts here that will serve on the panel to provide their perspective of transportation funding and finance. MTI will also examine the results of the eighth year of a national public opinion poll looking at taxpayers' responses to transportation taxes and fees. Thanks once again to our keynote speaker, the Honorable Jim Bell, Chairman of the California Senate Transportation and Housing Committee. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our panel of experts. Please note that there are cards for your questions located throughout the room. They will be collected and brought to me here at the podium. First today, we will hear from Dr. Asha Weinstein Agarwal, Director of the Mineta Transportation Institute National Finance Center and Professor of the Department of Urban and Regional Planning at San Jose State University. Her research focus is on transportation policy and planning, including finance, bicycle and pedestrian planning, and transportation history. Next, we'll hear from Nuria Fernandez, General Manager and CEO of the Valley Transportation Authority. Nuria's professional career includes planning, design, construction of mass transit systems, airport operations, and policy development of federal programs. Her career has taken her from the LOX in Panama to Chicago O'Hare's International Airport. Ms. Fernandez joined the Mineta Transportation Institute Board of Trustees in 2006 and currently serves as our chair. Following her presentation, we'll hear from Mr. Carl Guardino, one of Silicon Valley's most respected business and community leaders. He serves as the president and CEO of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group, a public policy trade organization representing nearly 400 of Silicon Valley's most respected companies. He serves on the California Transportation Commission, and twice he's been named as one of the five most powerful people in Silicon Valley. He's championed several successful ballot measures and initiatives to fund transportation and housing. Next, we'll hear from Steve Heminger. He's the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, a trustee for the Mineta Transportation Institute as well. For MTC, the Regional Transportation Planning and Finance Agency for the nine-county San Francisco Bay Area. Steve and his team allocate more than $1 billion per year in funding for the operation, maintenance, and expansion of the Bay Area's surface transportation network. Our final panelist will be Mr. Bill Higgins, Executive Director of the California Association of Councils of Government, also known as CALCOG. He works on day-to-day policy issues that improve the ability of regional governments to serve their member cities and counties. Previously, he spent 11 years as a senior staff attorney, program manager, and legislative representative for the League of California Cities and its nonprofit affiliate, the Institute of Local Government. And before we formally begin our program, I'd like to welcome each of the other Mineta Transportation Institute trustees who've joined us today. In the front row, we have Trustee Ann Canby, Mort Downey, Diane Wooden-Jones, Beverly Swaim-Staley, and back there I see Rose Gilbo. Thank you for joining us for today's presentation. Now, to kick us off, let's hear from Dr. Asha Agarwal, who will discuss the findings of year eight of our national transportation poll. Thank you.
Thank you for that introduction, Karen. And I'm sorry the senator has already left, but I just want to say I felt very inspired to know that we have an elected official in our state who seems to have such an excellent grasp of transportation policy and has really been very courageous in leading us to what I hope will be an ability to really improve our transportation system. And the remarks I want to make today are actually somewhat apropos, since there has been discussion of the politics of raising transportation funding in our state and current concern. Certainly the media has been hyping this recall initiative for one of our elected officials down south in response to his vote in favor of Senate Bill 1. And that's what I'm going to talk about today, public opinion. I'm very pleased to be here to share. You're getting breaking news, so to speak. This is our first release of results from year 8 of an annual survey looking at public opinion about raising transportation taxes and fees, as well as some questions related to support for public transportation in our country. I'd like to acknowledge the Mineta Transportation Institute, which has very generously funded this study over 8 years now, which is rare to be able to do a trend poll for this long, and also my co-author, Hillary Nixon, who's unfortunately not able to be with us today. Now, as we probably all know, it's conventional wisdom that Americans apparently hate taxes in general, and in particular, we hate the transportation tax. And you can, which is the one of the key sources of transportation funding in this state, but in every state around the country. Money coming from both our state and federal transportation gas taxes. We can read newspaper articles all the time, quoting someone or else. Others saying Americans hate taxes, and you hear that claim repeated again and again at events like today. And then again, as we just heard in California, there's been agitation. Oh, you know, are people opposed to the tax that our legislature just passed? But is this conventional wisdom that Americans hate the gas tax really true? You know, we tend to hear about the people who are very upset about something, a vocal minority, but what about the silent majority? Do they feel the same as that vocal minority or perhaps differently? It's very tricky to pin down the truth about any kind of public opinion, and gas taxes is no exception to that. But based on the polling that we've been doing for 8 years, I would suggest that the conventional wisdom is perhaps not entirely accurate, and that the public is not actually so opposed to the gas tax as we might be led to expect just listening to some of the media coverage. So we've been doing this poll for 8 years now to learn about public opinion on transportation taxes. And this year's, like the previous years, was a national random digit dial phone survey. We asked 1,201 people this year their opinion on a number of transportation tax questions. Random digit dial polls are those annoying things where you're maybe having a nice family dinner or perhaps a Sunday afternoon nap, and ring, your phone rings, and there's some person on the phone asking for just a few minutes of your time to answer some important questions. We conducted the poll in English and Spanish, and we included cell phones, a large proportion of cell phones, as well as landline phones. And we mostly asked people their opinions about gas and mileage tax options, all at the federal level, because these are the two sources, you know, key sources of revenue that are most in discussion at the state and federal level. Now, before I get to sharing a few of our results, a few of the numbers, I want to stress that the results of our poll are not going to be a good guide to assess public opinion on a particular piece of legislation or ballot measure in a particular place, because, you know, the details of any tax initiative and the local community's concerns change public opinion. So no survey can be applied kind of generically everywhere. But what I think our poll does very well and provides really good sort of takeaways that any community can apply is that we ask about people's support for different variations, for example, on gas taxes and to a lesser extent on mileage taxes, and we see big differences in support depending on how the tax is structured or framed. And so it's that comparison between different, for example, gas taxes that I think gives us useful information that we can take away. Now, let me just start with when we asked about people about the most generic, plain version of a gas and mileage tax. And we just told them in both cases that the revenue would be used for transportation purposes, but we didn't give people any additional information. We got a pretty clear message from those responses about those two taxes. Not super popular. So when we asked people if they would support increasing the federal gas tax by 10 cents per gallon, for transportation purposes, no other information, we got 36% of people saying they would support that option. When we asked about the concept of a new flat rate mileage tax of a penny per mile on every mile you drive, even less popular, only 23% support, very low. However, these low numbers are really not the end of the story. I would say they're just our starting point. Because we discovered that in all the cases where we asked variations on those, giving people more information or changing, for example, how the revenues would be spent, support went up. So let's just, as a starting example, let me share the numbers for what I'm calling a green mileage tax. So the generic version was just a penny per mile for everybody. We then asked people, well, what if we structured this so that the average rate was a penny per mile, but the specific rate that any driver pays is based on how polluting that vehicle is? So if your car is more polluting, you pay a higher rate. If it's less polluting, you pay a lower rate. In that scenario, we got support of 45% of Americans saying, yes, I could support that. Again, what I think is really important is not so much that 45% number in and of itself, but comparing the 23% that would support the sort of plain version versus 45% that said they could support this version. That's almost a doubling in support based on changing the structure of the tax. And a similar pattern held for the gas tax, where we tested, I think, 7 different versions of a gas tax increase. When we asked people about a 10 cent per gallon gas tax increase that would be spread over 5 years, so going up 2 cents a year for 5 years, support went up to 58%. That's an 18 percentage point increase in support for the same, essentially, 10 cents per gallon increase when you spread it out over 5 years as opposed to when you did it all at once. And this was still just telling people everything was sort of generically for transportation. And I'll give one last example here, which is we asked people, well, what if we had a one-time 10 cent per gallon increase in the federal gas tax, but we dedicated the revenue from that increase for projects that would be for maintaining streets, roads, and highways? When we asked that, we got support by 78% of our respondents. That's what I like to call a super comfortable supermajority. In California, you need 2/3 for a so-called supermajority. Well, 78% is quite substantially above even that. And again, coming back to this point I made it a little bit ago, what I think is so important is not that 78% number on its own, but comparing that to the 36% who said they would support that same pocketbook hit to them of a 10 cent per gallon increase in the gas tax if it was just kind of generically for transportation. We got 42% more people who said they would support that tax increase if it was dedicated for maintenance compared to if it was just kind of airy-fairy for transportation. Let me now turn to trends over time, since one of the things that I think is very special about our survey, because most of similar things are one-time efforts, is we've been doing this 8 times, so over 7 years. And we wanted to see, well, how have things changed over that period? 2 key takeaways. One is that from year to year for all these taxes, there's really very little change. You know, maybe a few points up, occasionally a few points down. But what we see when we look at that whole period going back to 2010 is that there is a very, it's not huge, but there is a very steady and noticeable increase in support for all of these taxes with one exception. And that's the flat rate mileage fee. There, people didn't like it in 2010. They still, only 23% of them that like it. That just hasn't changed. But for all the other taxes over this period, we've seen an increase in support that's ranged anywhere, depending on the tax, between 9 and 27 percentage points. Last, let me turn to just a few results related to public transit. One key finding is that the public supports a better transportation, a public transportation system. 83% said that expanding and improving public transportation in their state is an important priority. We also asked a series of questions to find out how people think transit costs are covered. In this audience, probably most of you know this, but the fares we pay do not cover the full cost of transportation, but does the general public know that, we found out that only a little more than half of people understood this fact. A final set of survey questions delved into respondents' beliefs about the best way that Congress could raise additional revenues to improve transit. I can't report everything, but one important finding was that two-thirds of our respondents thought that it was or would support using current federal gas tax revenues to pay for public transit, as well, of course, as to paying for our road and highway system. So just to quickly sum up, I think the survey results suggest that transportation tax increases can be acceptable to the public, but it depends very much on the specifics of what that tax measure is. Support for gas and mileage taxes can be significantly increased if we really think carefully about the tax structure and how it's explained to the public and how we specify the use of those revenues. And on the last point, dedicating the revenues to certain purposes makes the taxes far more appealing to the public. And the three purposes that we tested out and that really seemed to resonate with the public were using that revenue for a better environment, better safety, and most especially better maintenance, which is exactly one of the key things that our California legislators have done with their recent bill, which I think is very affirming that the legislature and the public are actually probably, you know, pretty well in tune with each other on this. And finally, I should mention we have far more data available. There's a handout at the very back at that round table if you want to pick it up on your way out that gives just some highlights from this year's survey and a link to the full report, which you can download from the MTI website for free. And you can also just sort of Google my name and MTI and you'll get to the same place as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Asha. Next, we'll turn to Nuria Fernandez.
Thank you very much, Karen, and good morning to all of you. Before I give you some thoughts around what's been happening in Santa Clara County, I just wanted to once again thank Senator Bell for his leadership. It has been an amazing ride here in California these past couple years. The work that went into developing and then actually succeeding the passage of SB1 is a cause for celebration. But he is a giant of transportation, as all of us know in this state. He has been carrying our water and standing firm all the way back to the cap and trade, which provided a lot of funding for transportation initiatives all around the environment. So I too believe that the movement that we have been seeing for the past 7 months is one that's not only going to transform mobility in the Bay Area, but it's really going to have an influence throughout the entire region, the state, and the country. Huge economic returns when we invest in transportation infrastructure. Just do the numbers. For every dollar of investment in transportation infrastructure, there's a $4 to $10 return. And one of the most important aspects of it, of course, is the creation of jobs, jobs, jobs. In the Santa Clara County, we saw an increase in job growth last year of 3%, and it was 5.2% the year before that. So that this is really going to be not only creating opportunities, but also bringing such great economic growth and prosperity to the region. So I'll start talking a little bit about something that happened in November. That was the passage of the 2016 Measure B. This is a 30-year half-cent sales tax that's going to generate $6.3 billion. This is $6.3 billion for needed transportation infrastructure that ranges from local street and road improvements, expressway extensions, and also, of course, culminating with the connectivity. So it's We created nine categories of program areas, and those nine categories fall within three buckets. The first one is safety. So the Caltrain grade separation, six grade separations in three of our cities for a cost of about $700 million to separate Caltrain, provide that reliable service, but yet also introduce the safety aspect into the mobility. And then we also also have a bike and pedestrian, $250 million in bike and ped. We know how important it is for us to provide different modality opportunities to the people who live and work and play in our county. And bringing more emphasis into the bicycle aspect of health and mobility, in addition to providing safe pedestrian paths and trails. On the mobility side, we have about $1 billion between expressways, county expressways, and highway interchanges. There's $1 billion for local streets and roads. This is one of the most sought after categories, given that all of our cities are experiencing different degrees of pavement condition. And if we recognize that in Santa Clara County, we have 2 million people based on the last census, and the Department of Motor Vehicles reported 1.6 million vehicle registrations. And that includes trucks, of course, for companies. But just looking at that balance, with 1.6 million vehicles with an average of 2 tons traversing through our county roads, highways, expressways, day in and day out, that 6 inch of pavement gets a pretty pounding. So clearly, getting the roads back to a state of good repair and bringing up that PCI, the pavement condition index, not only is going to help us relieve congestion, but it will offer a better quality of experience through our road network. We also, within the mobility, we have a category called it's the transit service, and it's $500 million. And this is to provide all kinds of alternative services for the low income, seniors, and disabled. And it's one that's also we're going to be looking to work with those communities on the first mile, last mile solutions to public transportation. And then when it comes to regional connectivity, of course, the number one is BART, but I just want to mention for a few minutes about Caltrain and the capacity enhancements for Caltrain. The Caltrain customer base is growing exponentially. And with the electrification program and the need for providing more capacity at the existing stations, there's going to be a need for extending platforms and making the necessary capital investments to make those stations be able to hold the capacity, but also make them more convenient for the riders. And also when, at some point in the future, when high-speed rail comes, that all of these activities can happen within an infrastructure system that can accommodate both types of services. And the big prize for us is the Phase 2 for BART. The Measure B is going to provide $1.5 billion. Now, the BART Phase 2 project is a $4.7 to $4.9 billion project. It's 6 miles that's going to bring BART service into downtown San Jose and terminate at the city of Santa Clara by the existing Caltrain station. That 6 mile is going to be in underground, and that's a little more expensive than building the open cut that we are currently doing for phase one. But it's critical because it's now going to create what we have been calling the final ring of connection between the East Bay, downtown San Jose, up through Milpitas, East Bay, Milpitas, downtown San Jose, and then the connections onto Caltrain at the Diridon Station all the way up the peninsula. Being able to provide that level of regional mobility just opens up opportunities, not only for the manufacturing plants that are continuing to sprout along the East Bay, but then all the opportunities for the tech companies and other types of industries along the peninsula, with the city of San Jose being a nexus and a connection to make that possible. The other area I wanted to cover was on the growing the pipeline of needs. When we embarked on the journey for what culminated in the Measure B It was a journey that involved many different groups to make it possible. It was the stakeholders, but it was spearheaded by our business community that recognized the value of transportation investment. Under the leadership of Carl Guardino, we want to thank him again publicly for everything that he was able to do. He had to give up family life for a bit to dedicate to a cause that at the end of the day is going to make such a big difference to the way that we, the decisions that we make about how we move within our county and within the region. But we put out, at the very outset of this process, we put out a call for projects to all 15 cities and our county. And the result was a total of 600 projects that added up to about $48 billion. And if you do the math, if a 30-year ballot measure for half-cent sales tax only generates $6 billion. So to be able to get to $48 billion, that was going to take many, many years. Some of us will never enjoy the benefit of some of these projects. But I just wanted to put that out there because we heard some large numbers for the highway backlog, and we do have a significant backlog. That $48 billion does include some highway in addition to public transit. But all of this to say that the needs are always going to exceed the funding available. But what we can celebrate today is that in the past 7 months, some amazing things have happened. Not only the passage of Measure B in November, but then just this past April was SB1, and SB1 does provide significant funding to help us start chipping away at our backlog of needs. And just as recent as this week, then we had SB 95, also known as RM3, passed by the Senate. So there is a recognition to transportation investment, and that transportation investment is going to help us attract more businesses, but also help people connect to where they need to go, help people make decisions about where they want to live. So the housing element is an overlay that is significant to the transportation investment. And the pipeline also starts to bring forth or put onto the light the need for maintenance funds to be able to not only maintain the investment that we have all signed up for, but also to be able to continue providing reliable service that is not disrupted, that is dependable, and that can help us address the increase in the congestion that's happening on our surface roads by providing people an alternative, individuals an alternative, one that will fit within their schedule and that can also get them to where they need to go and at the time that they need to get there. Lastly, I just wanted to spend a few minutes talking about building for the future. And I talked about the BART project, but we also have in the SB 95 and the Regional Measure 3, also known as Regional Measure 3, we have what will be the final funding that will be necessary to complete the extension of our Capital Light Rail to East Ridge, which is in the east side of San Jose. And this would be a tremendous boost for that community. It's going to take our light rail to that end point, but bring opportunities for an area that has a lot of challenges in terms of jobs in that particular segment of the city, and bring those individuals who live there onto our light rail and allow them to connect at Milpitas onto BART so that they can now benefit from all of the employment opportunities along the East Bay. So that's going to be significant. The other one is building a 21st century Diridon Station in downtown San Jose. I know you've all heard the news that the city of San Jose next week will be having conversations with Google about this mega campus. And the location should be no coincidence. It's the perfect location given the current utilization at Diridon Station, which is the Capital Corridor and ACE and Caltrain, of course. But the potential once BART comes into downtown San Jose and has a station access at Diridon, and then the future high-speed rail. So that will be, the Diridon station will be the busiest intermodal transfer facility in Northern California. And it's going to open up amazing opportunities, not only for the immediate area, but also for the benefit of the economic growth along the entire corridor from Oakland all the way through San Jose and then up the peninsula. So this is tremendous. It's great news. We're all very excited about what the future potential of that is and recognize that we have to have a 21st century station to accommodate that many movements. And it's not just about rail, because we do have a very robust bus transit center at Diridon that will just continue to be enhanced. We not only have the Valley Transportation Authority bus services that connect through the Diridon station, but we also welcome the Highway 17, Santa Cruz Metro, and the Monterey Salinas. And in addition to that, Greyhound moved in last year, so they will be part of this major intermodal facility.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
And then the last piece on building for the future is really looking at our express lanes. We want to expand our express lane program, our toll express lanes program, to include the 237 and 101, because then it will connect up the peninsula through San Mateo and continue with that. What we believe is not only it's not the way of the future, it's the way of today, so that we can provide that added mobility and options to those that want to pay to get to where they need to go faster. So this is just to name a few of the things that are happening a bit south from here. And one last thing, my staff asked that I not leave here without mentioning technology and how important it is for us as we're looking at all of these infrastructure improvements and all this added funding that's been made available to interject technology into it. It's going to be important that we need to recognize that autonomous vehicles they're everywhere right now and in development, and they'll be everywhere on our roads in 5 years or less. And interconnected autonomous vehicles are going to be part of the whole modality of our mobility network. And given that we are the most of what I do is on the public transportation side, is making sure that we too are interconnected and that we do not become irrelevant as it relates to technology advancing to a pace that we have not been able to keep up with. So to that effort, we have made a conscientious decision to, one, begin by embracing renewable energy, and I will be adding 20% of my fleet will be an electric fleet over the next few years. The first 5 buses will be rolling onto our property at the end of this year, an additional 5 next year, and then we'll continue to grow it from that point on. I think it's so important, not only as we are trying to preserve this fragile environment that we live in, but it's also recognition that lighter vehicles and renewable energy are going to be really good for our roads as well. So with that, I think I will just stop here and thank you very much for being here today. Look forward to answering your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Nuria. Nuria, excellent comments. Very much appreciated. Let's turn now to Carl Guardino, CEO of the Silicon Valley Leadership Group.
Dr. Karen Philbrook, thank you. It's always an honor to be at the Commonwealth Club, and I appreciate that you lowered your standards by inviting me onto this august panel today. When it comes to traffic relief and transportation improvements, we have a choice. We can be engaged or we can be enraged. I always think that engaged is not only more positive, but certainly more productive. So if I phrase it another way, talk is cheap, traffic relief is not. Let me take a moment to glance back as we look forward, as I was asked to add a perspective of a progressive, proactive business group that has supported more tax measures for specific improvements than probably any organization in California. We are celebrating our 40th anniversary at the leadership group next month. If you didn't bring gifts today, that's okay. You still have 30 days to shop. And in that time, we have not only supported and sponsored, but helped design and lead 5 different traffic relief measures, 4 in Santa Clara County, 1 in Santa Cruz County, as well as work helping to co-lead regional and state measures as well. So let me look at those for just a moment and the impact we hope they've had for the quality of life as well as the economic vibrancy of this beautiful place we call the Bay Area. The first was in 1984 with a measure designed by a county supervisor and the then CEO of what was called the Santa Clara County Manufacturing Group, as she sat on her porch, quite pregnant, expecting her first baby, lamenting the future of our region trapped in traffic. That then county supervisor is now Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren, an amazing force, and we led the state's first specific project transportation half-cent sales tax called Measure A. It won. It built Highway 85, improved Highways 101 and 237, all on time and on budget. Why? Because we had the good sense to steal a young man named Will Kempton from Caltrans to run that program. Will has been my mentor in many ways ever since, including running campaigns, but also running itself, though now age has caught up and I can beat him on the trails. The second measure was a measure in 1996 for 19 more specific road and transit improvements. Why were we able to go back to our voters? Because of promises made and promises delivered from the first measure. It's funny, when you keep your word, private citizen to private citizen, they tend to trust you again. That 9-year measure delivered 18 of those 19 called for improvements. One was set aside because voters changed their mind about running a diesel Caltrain type system to connect with BART in the East Bay. They wanted BART extended, not a diesel type of Caltrain running through Milpitas to it. Those 18 improvements all delivered on time and on budget. Those two measures created a movement in California. 24 of California's 58 counties are now what are called self-help counties, something that Will Kempton came up with to unite these counties, that if we were going to tax ourselves rather than being penalized by the state for our initiative, we would actually be rewarded. That self-help county movement, those 24 counties, 80% of California's population, delivering about 1 of every 2 transportation dollars currently in the state of California. That may change after the victory of SB1, but that is certainly the current number. That led us to the year 2000 in a measure that was called in the media the BART tax, because we wanted to finally become a BART county. It wasn't limited to BART, $153 million to modernize Caltrain and other rail and transit improvements. But that first 10-mile segment of BART was certainly a big portion of that measure. Thanks to the leadership of our Valley Transportation Authority, that first 10-mile extension is going to open ahead of schedule and roughly $100 to $150 million under budget. If it weren't for Leslie Rogers, who's here today in our Commonwealth Club audience, we probably wouldn't have had such a strong federal partnership. Leslie, thanks for your vision and belief in our region and that wonderful rail extension that's being built. If you're not invited with a red carpet to that opening ceremony, then there was a mistake in the invitation planning. 2008 was our next measure because the FDA rightfully told us, we're not giving you a dime if you can't show us you can operate and maintain that BART extension that you're building. So we went back to our voters. for an increment, not a whole half a cent, but a portion, for the ongoing operation and maintenance of that BART extension. Our visionary voters passed that measure as well. Do you ever think your vote doesn't count? 2008 was in the height of the recession. Out of more than 700,000 votes cast, needing 66.67% of the vote, we received 66.78% of the vote. We won by 0.11%. It took 4.5 weeks to count all the absentee and provisional ballots before we won, and we won by 2,225 votes out of more than 700,000 votes cast. I still have some extra yes votes in the trunk of my car in case a recount is ever called for. And then, as our VTA general manager, Nuria Fernandez, just alluded to in 2016, what a relief. 3.5 years of work, private citizens with our public sector partners, fashioning a measure to deliver more transit improvements, road repairs, and traffic relief throughout our Silicon Valley region. Not only did we win, but in a tax environment that is always turbulent, we were able to win by 71.74% of the vote. Not everyone was happy with November 8th of last year. There you go. The audience was a bit slow. But locally, we were very happy with that result. We've glanced back. Let's look forward. On that same ballot, in Seattle to our north and LA to our south, they passed what we call mega measures. Seattle, about a $45 billion vision and plan and funding package. LA, about $150 billion all at once. Wouldn't that be wonderful for the Bay Area? There's two ways to look at that. Picture your favorite painting. Is it in your mind? Great. Now, you can paint it all at once if you have all the resources, or think of your favorite painting as a jigsaw puzzle. Sometimes, as long as you know the painting you have in mind, you have to tackle these like a jigsaw puzzle, snapping in one piece at a time as long as you have the big picture as your ultimate goal. And that is where the leadership group would like to add value in our region in 2018. There are at least two counties in our region who are thinking about half-cent sales taxes, San Francisco and San Mateo. San Francisco graciously invited us to their very first organizing meeting. We will be all on board if it's a great, sound, policy-driven list of improvements, and I have no doubt that it will be. San Mateo, we're still hoping to be invited in. We're gentlemen at the leadership group. We come when we're invited. We hope that will happen as we are eager to help them should they move forward with a half cent. At the same time, Steve Heminger and his leadership at Metropolitan Transportation Commission are hoping for what will be called Regional Measure 3, up to a $3 bridge toll increase on the 8 bridges in our region, minus the Golden Gate. I'm sure he'll talk about that. We have no doubt that will be a good policy package as well. We're all in. Why is that important? Traffic doesn't end at our county lines. It's regional. Think the 101 Caltrain corridor, the Dumbarton corridor. All those cross-county lines, we need to help. And that brings us to one of our pet projects for 25 years of Caltrain. 79 miles. We've all worked together to get the electrification funds. $1.98 billion secured, shovel-ready and going. Thank you again, Leslie Rogers. Because of a federal partnership that just recently delivered $647 million to get us to that $1.98 billion. That takes ridership from 62,000 weekday passenger trips to more than 110,000. And not 50 years from now, that is going to be electrified by 2021. But what do we do after that? What are the modernization steps that go with electrification to get to 2 or 3x ridership? if we can get 250,000 weekday passenger trips on Caltrain, with 3 out of 5 being choice riders, getting out of their cars and onto rail cars, that's transformative in the 101 corridor that we no longer call a highway, we call the 101 parking lot. So we have a tremendous opportunity, we believe, in 2018 with 2 different ballots, June and November, so that we're all in our lane lines, getting all of these passed and all working together. And that brings me to my final item. You've been so gracious to be here. We would like to give each of you a memento of what we call our no traffic jams, jars of jam, from our Measure B effort last November. As my dear friend Sam Liccardo, the mayor of San Jose, said, we are going to work together to make traffic toast in the Bay Area.
Always a pleasure, Carl. Thank you so much. Turning now to Steve Himminger, Executive Director of the Metropolitan Transportation Commission.
Well, I'll tell you, I think in addition to yes votes, Carl's got to like crates of these jams in his car trunk everywhere I see them. You know, I've been doing this panel for a few years now, and as Karen can probably vouch for, I always try to stray slightly off subject. Today will be no exception.
Excellent.
And I'm going to borrow a page. I think it's from Sesame Street, if I can remember my childhood, with a word for the day, and mine is leverage. And leverage, I think, in recent years has acquired a bit of a bad reputation, right? That, you know, the banks were over-leveraged. All of us are over-leveraged with our credit card debt. And so we've got to get things back in balance. I happen to think, though, that in transportation finance, we are seriously under-leveraged. And let me describe 3 ways in which I think we are. The first has to do with policy. And you know, when you fund things, you can achieve more than just the objective of paying for the train or the bus or the road. Let me give you an example. A few years ago, we started a program at MTC called OBAG. It's the One Bay Area Grant Program. And what it pays for is pretty unexceptional. We pay for local road repair. We pay for bike improvements and pedestrian improvements. We pay for amenities around transit-oriented development. What's unusual is that in order to receive those funds, municipalities must certify that they have an approved housing element under state law. 70% of the money must be spent in areas that local government has deemed priority development areas for future growth. And each city must have a complete streets policy for pedestrian and bicycle movement. I think perhaps the most interesting part of this bargain is that the money is allocated to the various counties in the Bay Area, the 9 counties that touch the Bay, not based upon road miles or gasoline sales or any of the sort of traditional metrics that you use to allocate funding. Half of the money goes out by population, which again is not so unusual, but the other half goes out according to housing construction. And if you build more housing, you get more money next time. So to me, that's a very good way of talking about leverage, that in addition to getting the transportation improvements built, we also get some housing policy accomplished at the same time. And we are busy looking over our entire portfolio, which is now, I got an update for you, Karen, it's $2 billion, not $1 billion. We're looking over the entire thing to see whether we have other opportunities like that. I mean, I suppose, you know, the thought experiment, and I'll do this at some risk because Senator Bell is still here, but the thought experiment might be, what if Senate Bill 1 had included a provision in the bill about local road funding that said, before you get the local road money, you've got to meet your regional housing need obligation? Now, what he might say is that that probably would have cost him his two-thirds voting majority, and he was always a better politician than me. So I'll take that as a possible answer. But I think it's the discipline that I'm trying to suggest is that we ought to look at transportation funding as a way not only to accomplish transportation objectives, but other policy goals as well. The second way I think we're under-leveraged is with respect to performance. Here I'll turn to Washington for my example. The last big federal transportation bill called the FAST Act required USDOT, for the first time really, I think in any kind of systematic way, to adopt performance measures that the states and metropolitan planning organizations like mine would have to report data on. And I'm afraid that this is one of those cases where you better watch what you ask for, because DOT proceeded to produce dozens of performance measures, literally dozens of them, that we are going to keep track of, and keep track of them every year, as if performance wildly changes from one year to the next. The worst thing about it is there's no money riding on the performance results at all. And to me, that's a pretty significant wasted opportunity, especially given the amount of work that we're going to do, employing batteries of consultants to report on all these performance measures. In our new long-range plan, Plan Bay Area, performance gets you into the plan, and it gets you prioritized for money. And I think that's always a way of testing the seriousness of an idea, is whether you're willing to link funding, either the receipt of it or the non-receipt of it, to the result. The third way, I was looking just for a word that had a P in it, so it's pecuniary, which is, not a word I would use very often, but, that's show me the money. And here again, I think we are under-leveraged in our business. Washington still hands out 80-20 money, which is what we did. Actually, it was a little higher. It was 90-10. During the interstate era, but that was Uncle Sam achieving a pretty important national objective, which was to construct the interstate highway system. What happens with federal money now is largely disconnected with any kind of policy that I can determine, and it's essentially a formula exercise. States get their gas tax money back after they rinse it out a little bit in Washington for the return trip. And that 80-20 is not much leverage, right? The states have to put up 20% to get the 80. As a practical matter, the federal New Starts program, which is how we're funding the BART extension to San Jose, we now have a 50-50 ratio. I don't think it's in law, but it's in practice, certainly. And I really don't find anything objectionable about that. I mean, I don't like the idea that transit has a higher standard than highways, but my way would not be to make them both 80-20, but to make them both 50-50, because that would encourage more states like ours, like Senator Bell and his colleagues just did, that would encourage more states to increase their funding shares and not rely on the federal funding as an excuse not to raise their own. In that respect, I'd return back to Senate Bill 1, because one of the programs that I think does not get enough attention is the state-local partnership component. And that's a case where the state funding that will come will reward those counties that take it on their own to raise their own revenue. And I think it's about time that instead of just applauding self-help, we actually reward it. And so, again, I thank Senator Bell for that new program, and I think more of our funding needs to be in that fashion. We need to be encouraging, incentivizing, rewarding those that are helping us achieve not only our transportation funding objectives, but the associated policy goals that go with it, whether it's housing production, whether it's workforce training, as Senator Bell mentioned in his remarks. Transportation, I think we always in our business have to remember this. Transportation is a good servant and it's a lousy master, as an old friend of mine used to say. We're in the business of facilitating travel so that people can achieve other objectives. I think we've always got to remember that, and we've always got to support those objectives and remember that we're here to serve them, not the other way around. So it's a pleasure to be here again, and I hope I eventually veered back to the subject, Karen, before I was done.
Excellent comments. Thank you, Steve. Bill Higgins, Executive Director of CalCOG, take it away.
Thank you very much. I am the last speaker, which means all my talking points have been taken. But to apply some Sesame Street terms, now that that's been thrown down, I'm the guy from Sacramento, which makes me one of these panelists that are not like the others. And I actually am the executive director of CalCOG, which is the State Association of COGs and Regional Transportation Planning Agencies across the state, which means I get to work with some of the smartest transportation minds in the state, like Nuria and Steve. And for purposes of today's program, those two are my favorite members. I'm going to take us back to the question that was posed, which is about transportation funding. And are we there yet? And that's what I was thinking when I was preparing my remarks. And I realized I couldn't answer the question because, one, I'm not sure exactly where we're going. And two, I'm not sure if we have to have a question about who we trust to get us there. And let me try to, and I'm just going to hit on the first one really quick, but we are in a time of tremendous disruption in the transportation service industry. We haven't talked about what Uber and Lyft and other sharing services are doing to our transit systems and our mobility, what different lifestyles, particularly here in the Bay Area, are doing, what the new Google developments like the new Google Center will do for how we need or don't need to transport people and how they connect. We've hinted at autonomous vehicles. There's just so much going on right now. Even if we change the fuel source over to electric vehicles like is in the governor's plan, a tremendous amount of change is going there. So I'm not sure that I can say that we're going there yet because I'm kind of like the guy who's lost and needs to get out and ask for directions, right? And so, but I think knowing that you need to ask for directions is an important point. Well, what does that mean for all of us? Well, it means that one challenge I think we have in our transportation policy is allowing innovation within government to actually address the new challenges, because no government wants to fail, right? A test thing that doesn't exactly work out right is bad politics, but this region, above all, values failure in its private industry, right? Most of the fortunes are built on at least a few failures. But we do not hold our public service to an entirely different standard because that's wasting taxpayer money. And so that's a challenge I think we have as an industry to address this change that's coming and be innovative and allow failure. I don't know if that's an answer. So I don't have a crystal ball. I can't predict the future, but I know the future is changing. It's something we all have to talk about, maybe for next year's panel. So let's talk about, do we trust who's in the driver's seat? And on that, I want to kind of roll back to the accountability provisions that we always have had around funding and transportation funding. At the state level, we have the constitutional protections that Senator Bell discussed that kind of lock the transportation dollars in a lockbox. But traditionally, as Carl was talking about, the promises made, promises kept concept around the self-help county model, the accountability has always been around delivering projects, right? You vote for a sales tax, and then the projects are on the list. You understand that you're going to get those projects. You vote for it, and then the projects appear. And in the case of Los Angeles a few years ago, they were able to accelerate all their projects because they took their 30-year funding source, bonded on it, got it. It was 30 and 10, and they were able to produce that out the door. I was asked to talk a little bit about Los Angeles's Measure M because it is the local half and the local partner to SB1. And let me stop and just go back on SB1 just a second. And the legislature did something really remarkable. they did something so remarkable that when Steve spoke to this group last year, the legislature contradicted him when he went off topic. Because last year, when I was checking the talk, he said the legislature won't vote for a tax when you talked about taxing. So I just thought I'd bring that there. It's very few. Usually Steve's doing that to me. So, and they actually voted for a tax that is kind of the opposite of what our self-help measures are, because it's a maintenance tax and it's a rehabilitation tax, and that's a harder thing to track and be accountable for and say yes, we delivered that. In the case of LA Metro, they did $120 billion. Sales tax measure, 120 over 40 years, or put a different way, SB1 is a 20 or $52 billion program over the next 10 years by the forecast. In LA County alone, Measure M raises $29 billion in that same amount of time. So in one county. So that's a big deal. And what they have in order to be accountable is they have a number of projects. You probably have noticed that they are building out their rail when you're out there. They're drilling a big tunnel under Beverly Hills. No controversy there. But they're doing some remarkable capacity infrastructure things. What SB1 does is the less sexy, you know, filling a pothole. And how are you accountable to the voter? How does the voter know that you were successful when the pothole never appeared in the first place because your maintenance plan was on top of it, right? It's harder to understand. And that's actually the challenge that the California Transportation Commission has right now. Over the next 9 months, they're developing a number of guidelines to assure that accountability so that there are reports out, so that they understand how this money is being used, so that the taxpayers will have some confidence. So I'm not sure if we're there yet or not, but I do think it's important to think about what SB1 does and doesn't do and what the local sales tax measures do and do and how they're working together. Because I have heard people say, well, we just adopt a $50 billion plan, but you need more money. Well, the needs have always been really great. I think SB1 is a tremendous investment in our existing infrastructure. But to coin a phrase, and this is one that I really liked that Steve used before, and I'm glad you didn't use this line, Steve, is SB1 was really good at addressing our aging pains, but it doesn't do a whole lot to address our growing pains. And that's where the local sales tax measures and the RM3 measure will fit in to kind of create a fabric and a network of transportation investment. I think it's time for questions.
Thank you so much to all of our panelists. We've received 17 excellent questions with 8 minutes to respond to all, so I apologize in advance if we don't get to your particular question. Asha, the first one is for you. Are there major regional differences in the transportation tax surveys? For example, urban-rural, blue states versus red, and how does this relate specifically to the state of California?
So, great question. First of all, I can say regionally within the U.S., we looked at the 4 main census districts, very little variation. I can also say just in terms of looking at respondents who either identify as Republicans or Democrats, yes, there is some difference. But what was really striking to me is that, for example, even a large majority of Republicans supported many of these tax options, including the maintenance ones. So yes, there are differences, but it's not a stark, you know, if you're a liberal or Democrat, yay for taxes, and if you're a Republican, no, it's not that way. In terms of California, we have not been able to do a formal analysis of just the California data. We've been hoping to, but sort of hint to funders in the audience, we haven't had any funding to have the time to do that. But just kind of casually behind the scenes doing some back of the envelope stuff, it's really not very different. So you could kind of roughly apply our national results to California. In the interest of the other questions, I'll stop.
Thank you. Next, for Carl. All 5 measures you mentioned are entirely sales tax based. Seattle's Prop 1 was composed of a half-cent sales tax, property tax, and motor vehicle excise tax. Have you considered diversifying local funding options?
Pragmatism or purism? we live in a democracy in California. We live in a two-thirds democracy, unlike almost any other state in California, for tax measures at the local level. We have tested every type of tax and fee possible within that framework of what you and I as citizens are willing to reach into our own wallets to fund. So far, the only one that resonates well in transportation in our region is a sales tax. So, pragmatically, we could wait for different tax mechanisms that we might prefer, but we also don't want to be stalled in traffic forever waiting for that to finally pull well.
Thank you. Steve, do you think that there's political will for a bridge toll increase so close to the passage of Senate Bill 1?
Well, given how wrong I was about SB 1, maybe I should say no, and then they'll pass it. I do think, as Bill suggested, that you can look at the two measures as complementary and not competitive. I think, as I count up the money in Senate Bill 1, about 75% is really earmarked for state of good repair work. There is significant funding in that measure for expansion, especially for public transit. But it is a minority of the funds, and I think that's appropriate. So I think the partnership that is evolving here between state and regional slash local initiative is that, you know, the state has now stepped up for a very significant investment in the aging pains, and now it's up to us to deliver on the growing pains. So we're looking forward to it. We have done this twice before. Regional Measure 1 and Regional Measure 2 both passed. One advantage they have, apropos Carl's response, we live in a majority democracy for bridge tolls, not two-thirds, because they are considered fees, not taxes. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty significant advantage we have. We also have the advantage that when people vote on these things, we pool the votes in the region. So an individual county can actually vote against it, and the measure can still pass, and then the measure takes effect in that county, and they get some of the money, too. So pooling votes is a way, I think, to lift all the boats, even if a couple of the boats are a little ornery about it.
Very good. A couple of you...
One sentence on that. Right now, the leadership group and two of our sister organizations are polling on this question about a regional measure through a potential bridge toll. And my sense is when we get those results back in the next week or so, they're going to be positive. And that just helps the work of Senator Bell carrying Senate Bill 595, the enabling legislation, and his colleagues to move forward in a productive way.
Very good. We'll look forward to those results. Nuria, there's a question that's been submitted a couple of times for you, and that is, does SB1 or RM3 have dedicated funding for VTA's Phase 2 of BSV?
Okay, thanks for that question, whoever. Oh, there you go. So as you all know, the second phase of BART, what we've done is we've created a really good toolbox of different funding sources. It's a $4.7 to $4.9 billion for the 6 miles. The federal government, our request to the federal government will be for about $1.5. So what it's looking like, it's about 60% overmatch. Part of that, part of the local funding, part of the local match includes $750 million from the state that was coming from cap and trade. With the passage of SB1, that provides some flexibility in terms of where funding that could be made available for this phase two. In addition to recognizing that in the measure, the 2016 Measure B that I referenced earlier, the $1.5 billion that's going to go towards the BART Phase 2 project is capped. And that's also been very clear. It's been stated in the law. So it's capped to 1.5. So having funds for BART Phase 2 identified in a potential regional Measure 3 and access to dollars through the SB1, I think it will help provide some certainty to the match that will be required from the state as we're moving forward with the project.
Thank you. Bill, a question for you. How will tax ballot initiative sponsors counteract tax and ballot fatigue?
Actually, that is a really good question. And I know that when we were in the SB1 coalition supporting the measures in the legislature, we worked with a coalition of called the Fix Our Roads Coalition. And we did a lot of polling, a lot of focus groups, and some of the design of SB1, I think, benefited from some of that. For example, the idea that voters were more interested in spreading the pain across two or three or four different revenue sources instead of just one was something that the focus groups approved. I think that you have to crack through the general tax good government message and really craft a message that tells people how they will benefit. And that is why that has been the model of the self-help, why they've been so successful over time. And it's also a credit to the senator for actually doing a general purpose maintenance bill, because again, that's a harder message to sell generally, even though the polling, I think what's happened is our infrastructure's gotten so to a point where people just know something has to be done. But on these complementary measures, it's really about messaging, and of course we have social media and a lot of things to kind of crack through and make that education, face-to-face kind of education or person-to-person, account-to-account, to show the benefits of our investment.
Very good. Thank you. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program for one last question with a very quick response. Any one of the panelists may answer this. While specific tax measures are more palatable to voters, they can result in ad hoc, disconnected infrastructure. How can we ensure more holistic, connected transportation planning in the region, especially for public transit?
That's why, again, we liken it to a jigsaw puzzle, as we did with Measure B in Santa Clara County last year. People get it. If you're not just picking up one improvement, but you're showing on how that improvement fits into a transportation systems approach, smart residents in the Bay Area get that.
Yeah. I just want to add that we put together a transportation plan for our county, but that plan is part of the regional plan that the MTC coordinates. So clearly, as projects, funding is available for projects, we just keep filling in, as Carl said, we just keep filling in that canvas. But it's part, there is a plan, there's a vision, and there's a plan to for us to be able to achieve that vision.
And I would just say, a dear friend of mine who's the Hawaii Ironman world champion two times talks about, you know, a vision is a goal with a plan. So the vision comes first, then you have to have a goal and a plan to get there. That's what we need to do through RM3, through SB1, these countywide measures, as well as hopefully a mega measure, i.e. LA and Seattle at some point in our future.
Thank you. Any final comments from our panelists? Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us today. A very special thank you to Dr. Asha Agrawal, Director of MTI's National Transportation Finance Center, Ms. Nuria Fernandez, CEO of Valley Transportation Authority, Carl Guardino, CEO of Silicon Valley Leadership Group, we're almost done, Steve Heminger, Executive Director of the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, and finally, Bill Higgins, Executive Director of CalCOG. Thanks to today's keynote speaker, the Honorable Jim Bell, Chairman of the California Senate Transportation and Housing Committee. A special thank you to MTI Trustee Will Kimpton for moderating the morning session of today's program. And thanks to our audiences here on radio, television, and the Internet. Today's program has been sponsored by the Mineta Transportation Institute at San Jose State University. I'm Dr. Karen Philbrick, Executive Director of MTI, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know, is adjourned.